702 and Cape Talk.
Technobite with Aki Anastasio.
Technobite is brought to you by ESET Internet Security. Enjoy safer technology. How's it, Aki?
Eusebius, good morning to you. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Did you have a good weekend?
How was my weekend?
Yeah, I know, it was so cool. Far it was away. It's a distant memory, isn't it?
You know when you're fully present in radio, eh?
Exactly, as your alma mater would be as well. You're from Rhodes, right?
I am, and a lot of Rhodians around here.
Yes, a lot of them around here. So So it is with that in mind as I introduce our guests. And you know, this weekend was a very interesting milestone for the internet in South Africa because it was on the 12th of November... Okay, that we marked the 25-year anniversary. So the internet is 25 years old in South Africa. And where did it begin? It started off at Rhodes University. All those years ago, 25 years ago. But it's amazing.
So we don't just drink at Rhodes?
No, you don't. You actually work quite hard. Now, Mike Laurie, who was at the time the Director of Computing Services at Rhodes University, was responsible for the internet. And it's quite an interesting story how it all came about. So let's look back 25 years. I see Mike Laurie is joining us on the line. Mike, good morning to you.
Yeah, hi, Aki, good morning.
Yes, it's Aki and Eusebius here. If you take us back to 25 years to Rhodes University when the internet was first connected to the country, what on earth did you use it for 25 years ago and how did it all come about?
Oh, Aki, I don't think you got enough time to hear the full story. But the internet itself, the first, at a technical level, the actual internet packets, the IP packets, started flowing, say, 25 years and 2 days ago now. But that was a culmination of electronic mail, email that we were messing around with at Rhodes. We'd written ourselves, we had a mainframe computer, Control Data Cyber. It was, you know, physically quite big, fast as could be, very flexible in its networking. And we had, a few years earlier, written our own mail system so that we could send mail one to the other. All we could send to was anyone who could connect to that cyber, which was basically just a few people around the campus. But then sort of one thing led to another. There was a bit of a desire amongst the universities to have some sort of network in place. It seems to be a good idea. There was no sort of real formal project saying do this, do that, do the other thing. And it turned out that the mailing system we had developed on our cyber with its very flexible network could receive mail from IBM computers, which the ones up at WITS, at Potchefstroom, CSIR, and accept that mail, reformat it, change its
Mike, we're a little bit pressed for time on the show, but in a nutshell, you basically bought the first email into the country. But I was telling my colleague Eusebius, who we are on the show with, how much it cost, because it was a dial-up account. You had to physically dial up into a university in Oregon. And in those days, it took something like 10 minutes to download an email at an exorbitant cost.
Yes, Aki, it was expensive. The mail system that we had, which could then, it didn't dial to university, it dialed to an individual, a chap called Randy Bush in Portland, Oregon, the furthest part of the United States. And when we found that the email would flow and would exchange email with folk on the internet, this is before the internet connection itself.
Yes.
And we're using
what is the cost of a call in those days, Mike?
Well, I'm not sure the rands and cents value, but I was worried that the budget that I had was going to get blown and that we should then charge the users for messages.
Yeah.
And those messages they worked out at about a cent each.
Yeah.
The average message. Now, so this is text stuff. This is not sort of super pictures and whatever it is, just straight, simple text like you get on a page of typing.
When you look back 25 years, Mike, and you look at the speed of the internet today, can you believe how fast it is? Can you believe how far we've come?
It's incredible. It's totally unbelievable. I mean, I was driven to chase the internet connection. Yeah, when we had this dial-up, we said, look, let's try to get it to work on the internet directly. Because we could then connect any computer to any computer on the internet. Anyone who's on the internet could connect to anybody else. And this was not very many computers. You know, yeah. There was no web pages. There was nothing like that. And being able to connect from, say, a control data cyber into an IBM computer was magic, into a Burroughs computer, a Sperry Univac.
Extraordinary. So I bet it must be just like it was yesterday when you look back 25 years ago to today, and that first internet connection at Rhodes University, which you were responsible for on this day, the 12th of November. Some magic memories, Mike, and thank you for just sharing some of it with us. And if you go to techcentral.co.za, and if you go to mybroadband.co.za, two of the big tech sites in the country, they've got long interviews with Mike and what he's been up to, and it's quite extraordinary how far we've come since then. And thank you for joining us, Mike. Have a great day.
Fine, Naki. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
All the best. Cheers, Eusebius.
Do you remember your first internet connection, Eusebius?
Jeez. Actually, it was at Rhodes. Yeah, Pegasus Mail.
Pegasus Mail. I remember Pegasus Mail. So I remember I had this dial-up modem in those days, and you used to dial up on a telecom line, and I think the speed at the time, it was 9,600. It was just insanely slow compared to today. And I remember Incredible. One of the early websites was CNN, and listening to the first time in the late early 90s of actually streaming audio, and I thought, this is going to change things. But you're talking about things that are changing. You talk about industrialization, and a very interesting report was released out by the United Nations, and they're talking about industrialization and how developed economies are moving towards like really being mechanized and automating everything. And if you look, and it's quite interesting, I've been following this, with robotics and manufacturing, the top countries in the world right now are China, the United States, Germany, Korea, and the USA. Did I mention the USA? Those are the top five. Now, between those two countries, China in the last 3 years have accelerated their programming in robots. And I'm talking about robots that physically make things in a factory. This year alone, they will have gone from a population of robots that they've assembled over the last few years of 240,000 robots. China's going to now go to around about 600,000 robots. Now, what does this do? It really puts a huge impact, has a huge impact on, manufacturing processes and competitiveness, especially in Latin America and especially on the African continent, because now you've got all these countries where labor costs are no longer an issue. And this is the problem. And this is why when you talk about, robots and, doing so much more, and it's been happening. Yes, robots make cars, but now it's accelerating. It's taking robots to a new level, and certainly going to be something to look at, because this United Nations report saying that it could affect up to 2/3 of jobs in the developing countries.
But it's a horrible trade-off. Like, I'm no economist, but the trade-off is horrible, because on the one hand, you gain in efficiency. You can also drive down the cost of doing business.
Absolutely.
And that in turn can lead to economic growth, which we desperately need. But then you don't absorb the masses of people that are part of that, anything from 25% to 40%, depending on your definition of unemployment. So horrible, horrible, horrible trade-off between employment that needs to improve, and on the other hand, wanting your economy to be efficient.
And this is technology, and this is one thing I don't understand. Why our continent as a whole, why South America, we haven't invested more extensively in this? Because we should be manufacturing stuff here, not reliant on these other countries to bring in stuff. Now, to give you a comparison, China will be sitting at about 500,000 robots at the end of this year. North America, about 300,000. South Korea, about 250,000. Germany, about 250,000. And, collectively, both South America and Africa will not have more than 50,000 robots.
Really?
That is how stark the difference is. It's a staggering jump in economies.
What is the reason for the technological divide?
It's just that these countries have been spending massive amounts of money on buying this technology. China, for example, bought this massive robot manufacturing company from Germany called KUKA just recently, and I've seen images from these factories, what they can produce. You can make any process happen without the and I saw some amazing examples. For example, one robot replaces about 60 jobs in a manufacturing plant. So you can understand when they're starting to make everything using robots, it's going to impact us. But it's not in a negative sense, because some people will say, we find other things to do. But we really need to accelerate our economies to become more mechanized, more digital. And this is something that our continent as a whole needs to look very seriously at doing more aggressively. Now, I'm going to end off with the elections, the U.S. elections. And, Facebook has come under quite a bit of stick over the last few days. And over the weekend, I saw some interesting pieces in the New York Times, for example, as to how Facebook's algorithm influenced people's choices in voting for elections.
Now, I haven't followed this one, but I was so happy to see it on the runner, Aki, because I'm sick of us in the media being told that we manufactured Trump.
No, absolutely. Well, you know what happens? This is, we don't notice it. If you're on Facebook, for example, you might not notice the subtle differences. But basically, Facebook has this algorithm operating in the background that really decides on what you should be seeing in front of your screen. So those news stories that appear on your screen are what Facebook decides that Eusebius or Thomas or Aki should be seeing. And the U.S. elections is no different. Now, we know what happened in the last few days and what a surprise it was to so many people. But Facebook was one of those companies that was very pro, the Democrats. And the content that came out was not necessarily pro Trump. In fact, there was a post that I know from someone who posted a picture of themselves wearing a Trump supporter's T-shirt. And Facebook removed that. They removed the picture.
So what is the link here? Is the idea that in part it bred complacency?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, and there's there's a whole thing about the stories that are fake stories, and we discussed this last week. I mean, this is the whole thing with Facebook's algorithm, and there are people that are able to manipulate this algorithm to really make the stories appear on your timeline. And when there was a fake story claiming that Pope Francis, for example, is actually a refugee advocate who actually endorsed Trump, and that post that, came out of, I think, Macedonia or something, was shared almost a million times. And, millions of people saw this kind of thing. And it influences people's decisions. So looking forward to future elections, how are we going to, how are algorithms or Facebook, how is Facebook going to shape your idea of what the election is, as does mainstream media, sure. But, there's the whole thing of transparency. And in fact, Mark Zuckerberg released a statement just over the weekend saying that, just something saying that after the election, he basically said, many people asked whether fake news contributed to the result and what our responsibility is to prevent fake news from spreading. Of all the content on Facebook, said Mark Zuckerberg, more than 99% of what people see is authentic. Really? 99%? Come on, Mark Zuckerberg, pull the other one. I don't see that. I see a lot of fake stories. And he talks about the hoaxes and everything. But it's good that they're transparent and it's good that they're addressing this kind of thing, because where mainstream is becoming so much part of people's lives, people actually believe what they read.
That's true.
That's the scary part.
Absolutely. How do I look when I do this?
Oh, he's eating a grapefruit in front of Thomas and I, and he's biting into the grapefruit.
Management is listening.
I don't care. And the grapefruit juices are juice coming down his cheeks at the moment, and Bay is nowhere to be seen.
Thank you, Aki. We'll do it again next week.